Well, good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our 15th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Dustin Johnson designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shaddon Melke. Special thanks to Chef Josh Pauling from Home Cafe, Josh, for hosting dinner for our speaker tonight. Tonight's speaker has been writing since he was a teenager and published his first story in the Oklahoma County News at age 15. He's written about sports for the Daily Oklahoman, about forests, served as a military photographer in the Iraq War, and worked as a restaurant trade editor. After the Iraq War, he moved to Kentucky to marry the love of his life, and the rest, as they say, is history. He's been writing about bourbon and spirits for more than a decade, and is the author of 6 books, including the widely acclaimed Bourbon, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of an American Whiskey, published by Quarto Books, which Smithsonian Magazine named as one of the best books about food in 2016. His other notable books on spirits include Whiskey Women, The Untold Story, How Women Saved Bourbon, Scotch, and Irish Whiskey, published by Potomac Books in 2013. Bourbon Curious, A Simple Guide for the Savvy Drinker, published by Zenith Press in 2015. And hot off the press, and we have a copy up here, Rum Curious, The Indispensable Tasting Guide to the World's Spirit, published this summer by Voyager Press, an imprint of Quarto Publishing. He's the bourbon authority for the Kentucky Derby Museum, and since October of 2013, he's taught bourbon classes at the museum and hosted private bourbon tastings for convention groups. In 2014-2015, Louisville.com named his popular Legend series of bourbon tasting as one of the top events in Bourbon County. He serves as judge at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition and the World Whiskies Award Competition. When not writing or judging, Fred serves as the chairman of the Brain Injury Alliance of Kentucky Ball and frequently donates tastings, books, and photography to Bourbon and Bow Ties, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and many others. Please give a warm welcome to Fred Minnick. Fred?
Thank you.
Well, shit, after that introduction, I sound like I could walk on water. Thank you. So one of the first things that people ask me is, how do you drink for a living? First of all, I gotta start with a drink, right? I'm a drinks writer, so I have to have. I'm sorry, Barnes & Noble. I know you don't have a liquor license, but this is courtesy of Corsair, which is a local distillery here. Thank you very much, Clay, for donating this. Cheers, everybody. Thanks for coming out. Thanks to Barnes & Noble. That's a very nice rye. Sorry you can't taste it, but it's very nice. Where are you, Clay? Clay over there is the distiller for Corsair. So, while I am an author and everything, I view the distillers as the true celebrities of spirits. So, big round of applause for Clay for coming. Thank you. I've never had Corsair products. I highly recommend them. They're highly experimental, and they like to play around a lot with stuff, so they're very innovative. My story into how I got into drinks writing really begins with my time in Iraq. When I came home from Iraq, I was in a lot of ways wounded and very, very had a tough time getting back into the regular life, if you will. Life after the military is not always very easy for former soldiers. And I tried to go back to Iraq as a journalist, but I get rejected at every turn, and no one would go for that. And so I moved to Kentucky to be with the woman that, as Brian said, would be the love of my life and marry her. We now have a beautiful child. But I met her on eHarmony, of all places. So, the online dating world, changing my life. Moved to Kentucky do a job search, and the only job I could get was as a food editor at a restaurant trade publication. This was 2005. And I took that job, and when you write about food, you eventually write about booze, you know, because people eat and they drink, and sometimes a lot at once. And the restaurant industry likes to make a lot of money off of you eating and drinking. And so I started writing about that. I found, you know, I was like very fascinated with the alcohol side of the business. And I went out on my own as a freelancer, and one of the first stories I wrote about was about the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. And that was for a magazine called Successful Meetings. So a very bizarre first publication for me into bourbon. But it led to what I have now. And you know, when you're a freelancer, you've got a lot of strategies to try and make it. One of them is to write about what's in your backyard and what you're passionate about. And for me, it happened to be bourbon and bourbon. So I've always loved bourbon. Bourbon has been very much in my, you know, DNA, maybe actually quite literally when I was conceived. But there was, when I was in college at Oklahoma State, you know, I drank a lot of it, responsibly, of course, right? Responsibly. But so I kind of started this journey in 2006. And immediately after, I wanted to, you know, write a book. My first book that I would write on whiskey would be Whiskey Women. And, you know, the story of how I kind of got into this kind of brings in everything. Because the book I really wanted to write was the one that came out. The one you see right there was bourbon. But my agent at the time said, nobody wants a bourbon book. So you need to come up with something else, you know. And so I came up with Whiskey Women. It was something that I believed in. You know, women didn't get any credit for their impacts on American whiskey. I mean, zero. And come to find out, you just look in a little bit into the research side of things, and you learn that Sumerian women actually created beer. Egyptian women were the first to do distillation. Women owned brands like Lafroy, Dalmore, Bushmills. A woman created the Red Dripping Wax, the name, and owned half of Maker's Mark. And so women were a part of, you know, the distilling industry for a very, very long time. And they just never got any credit because, a little bit in part, because of prostitution. 1800s era prostitutes in the United States were very good whiskey salesmen, or saleswomen, excuse me. And the reason being, I suppose, that they were trying to get their fellas intoxicated so they wouldn't have to do other things. But it was not illegal to run a brothel. And so we have very good tax records of the brothels in the 1800s. And this I know it sounds funny and everything, but it's actually a little bit of a scholarly endeavor to see who was selling whiskey in that time. And prostitutes were the best sales reps for American whiskey. In fact, in New York in the 1850s, we have very good records to show that New York prostitutes were selling up to $3 million worth of liquor. And you know, that was almost equal to the other goods and services they provided their customers. That amount of whiskey that they sold actually nearly equaled the budget of the entire state of New York, and was the budget. It did equal the budget of like smaller states like Missouri, Illinois, and like Indiana. So that gives you an idea of how much that they were selling. And women who could sell whiskey were, you know, earned a premium. And they actually, a lot of them earned salaries, and they would earn more money for the more money, you know, the whiskey they sold. And so in the early 1800s, or the mid-1800s to 1870s, that's why you see a lot of the advertisement. You know, it depicts two men drinking in a brothel, or it has women drinking or, you know, dancing around a barrel or something. That was kind of some of the early branding of American whiskey. So moving on from that book, I did the Bourbon Curious. Bourbon Curious was a tasting guide, that was, in a lot of respects, connected a lot of the pieces in American whiskey that was missing, and that is truth. I don't know how many of you all are really into bourbon, but you can't trust a lot we see on a label. You know, the one line that I have in Bourbon Curious is that bourbon brands rival political ads for bullshit per square inch. So there's a lot of legends around bourbon. There's just a lot of straight out lies. In the about, you know, 10 years ago, you started having brands come out and say, "Our grandpappy came back with this yeast between his toes and made our family recipe from the exact." It's funny because this family recipe happened to be the exact same of a contract Indiana distiller and their recipe. Fascinating. And the fact that all these other brands had the exact same recipe as them. And by the way, their families also had that same recipe. And so this story was being told a little bit, but not really in depth into why and a little bit of the historical perspective. And by the way, that Indiana distillery was a former Seagram's distillery. And they had a lot of rye whiskey come on the market in the bulk market around between 2006 and 2010. And people would go in there and buy bulk barrels of whiskey. And they would slap a label on it, and they would fail to include the state of distillation. Now, that seems like, well, big deal, right? Well, in the 1930s, our government said that was a big deal, and they made it an actual regulation. And so you had all these. And what happens when you have a regulation and people violate it in this country? Cue up the lawyers, right? How many lawyers we have in here? None? Well, I'll tell you, there was a lot of class actions regarding that particular issue. So brands like Templeton, Redemption, High West, Smooth Ambler, these are labels that you see all over the place. Those were actually purchased from, a lot of that whiskey was purchased from the Indiana distillery. And if they failed to put on the state of distillation, they got sued. That's kind of been cleaned up a little bit, but it's amazing how many people still have grandpas that had the same exact recipe as that Indiana distillery. So there's still a lot of the bulk whiskey on the market. I also wanted, with that book, I also wanted to tell what people were making. There's a little shroud of secrecy in American whiskey. It's not as bad as it used to be, but they won't disclose, like, their recipes. For whatever reason, they don't want you to know what their mash bill is, even though it's the same as, like, five people in the business. And I happened, through good sources, was very kind enough to disclose those mash bills for them. So my book would become one of the first, validated sources of other people's recipes. So people like Clay could crack it open and learn what his competitors were doing in some way. So I tried to always bring, like, a little bit of, kind of journalistic approach to the spirits writing. And the reason why I say that is, spirits writers, we're going to struggle to get people to take us seriously. Yeah, I mean, I talk a good yarn, I drop a few F-bombs here and there. But in reality, the food writers and the food scholars get a lot of attention for when they find something that's kind of, changes what we think about barbecue. Whereas, the spirits writers, David Wondrich he writes this beautiful book on punch, and all it ends up doing is influencing people to have more punches at home for parties. But in reality, if we study drink and we study how we drink as a culture, you can really see our culture. You can see our what is influential to our people. And that's what led to bourbon, the rise, fall, and rebirth of American whiskey. It really starts in the 1700s. With people migrating west to Kentucky. We have several waves of migration into Kentucky. First, we've got the Daniel Boones, the pioneers, and with every single wave, we have distillers connected to them. Daniel Boone's cousin, Waddle Boone, was one of our very first distillers. In the religious wave of people coming here, there were two people who came here by the name of Elijah Craig and Basil Hayden. both of whom have bourbon labels named after them today. And in the third wave, well, this was, you know, this was a, we're a very active protesting community these days, correct? Well, back then, when someone didn't do what they agreed with, they found that in the case of whiskey distillers who did not agree with the tax collectors that were sent to them to collect taxes from George Washington and what was known as the whiskey tax, instead of, you know, their protest was capturing the guy and tarring and feathering him. So instead of protesting outside of Washington, they damn near killed the guy. But that led to George Washington calling up troops in what was known as the Whiskey Rebellion, and a lot of distillers would migrate west to Kentucky to kind of avoid the, you know, the throes of that, of the majority of those federalized troops. Now, there were already distillers set up in Kentucky, and the Whiskey Rebellion is often overplayed for its importance to American whiskey for Kentucky, but it did play a role. And there are very good records of showing that people came over here from that. So the whiskey tax is in place, and distillers feel disgruntled. And Thomas Jefferson becomes president. And one of his first like big acts is to repeal the whiskey tax. And when he repealed the whiskey tax, the tea and coffee importers were saying that he was placating to the rich in Tennessee and in Kentucky. So in a lot of respects, the early Kentucky distillers for early America was thought, they were thought to be some of the very first one percenters. They were wealthy. A lot of them were wealthy. A lot of them had horses. A lot of them had land. And the tea and coffee importers thought that Jefferson's repeal of the whiskey tax is kind of him trying to help the rich. So it was one of our very first arguments as a country, as, you know, taxing the rich was based on whiskey taxes. And in fact, following whiskey taxes, that's how we study most a lot of American whiskey history. And the once they're repealed, they're gone until the War of 1812. Anytime there's war, the taxes seem to return to pay for the war. They return to temporarily between an end around 1817. After that, America is in an all-America phase. It's like, what can we do to be more American and make ourselves unique and independent and separate ourselves from England and France? And one of the things that they decided to do was tariff rum and tariff molasses. Now, rum and molasses was connected to the Revolutionary War. We all know about the Boston Tea Party and the taxes on sugar and everything. Rum and molasses were right there in the thick of it. And while it wasn't the main reason why we went to war, it was a big part of it. So when the British taxed molasses and rum, the Americans did not care for that. And they protested and eventually would go to war for it. But as a nation, we decided to penalize rum to make way for American whiskey. And I would argue from a historical perspective, rum actually has a better early argument to be America's spirit. And in some cases, brandy has a better argument than America's spirit. Bourbon doesn't really get any kind of notoriety until the 1820s. Now, there are some records to show that, you know, it might have been under consideration, or Kentucky whiskey or copper distilled whiskey, specifically from predominantly corn, is connected to America. But prior to that, you have America drinking a lot of rum. We were drinking about 5 million gallons of rum a year, and we were making brandy all over the country. Wherever fruit was grown, we were making brandy. So in the 1820s and 30s, the Congress convened to specifically penalize rum. And one of the things that they said was that by allowing foreign rum to come in here, we're hurting American farmers. And so they made the argument that by tariffing molasses, they were actually helping America grow grain. And so that was a very powerful argument for a very new country, and it stuck. And so it was in the 1800s that rum, once the, you know, the glory drink of the world, this is the British Navy took it with them at every port. They actually had it, you know, every sailor would receive a pint of rum up until the 1970s. And so we as a country hurt rum. And at the same time, rum is very entrenched in slavery. So you have an ethical aspect for a lot of distillers or a lot of congressmen to penalize rum because it's connected to slavery. When we get into the 1850s and the 1860s, people around the world are starting to encourage sugar beet plantings because rum is connected to the sugar cane manufacturers that are enslaving people from all over the world. In Barbados, they're heavily enslaving certain tribes in Africa and in Ireland. They're enslaving all people from all over the world to try and harvest sugar cane. Sugar cane is an extremely labor-intense product. So they had a belief that by herding rum, they could then end slavery. So rum is a very complex spirit, and even today, it's connected to deaths in the sugarcane field. So it's very complex. It's very ugly in a lot of ways, but it's a part of those cultures, and it's a part of the world history. And by following bourbon and by following rum, you can see like how governments interact with one another based on, you know, spirits alone. After the Civil War, we start seeing a lot less rum in the ports of America. And when you do see it, it's at a premium because it's being highly tariffed. Jamaican rum, once kind of the bastion of, you know, that was the connoisseur's drink of choice because of its unique clove and all these different flavors to it, was now like two or three times more expensive than whiskey. Bourbon, it starts taking off. It has actually branding identification to it. So this is how whiskey was normally sold prior to, let's say, you know, 1840. They would just roll a barrel out and someone would buy it and just take it. Like, there was no one would really know who the barrel would be from. It wouldn't have any kind of like signature on it or anything. I mean, some of them would, but branding starts taking place in the 1840s and the 1850s, and you say, oh, that's Old Crow. That's E.H. Taylor in the 1870s. You were saying, like, it's James Miller's bourbon. So people would have a connection to the brand of that particular bourbon. So before Nike, before McDonald's, before Starbucks, even before Spencer's Coffee. By the way, this is amazing coffee. You guys drinking Spencer's? Yeah, you like Spencer's? The line was crazy. That's why I was late. But before all of that, American whiskey distillers saw opportunity with branding, and they were trying to brand themselves as unique and get some name recognition. There's one brand in particular that's still in existence today. Today it's a shit brand. Like, it's not as good as it was back then. It's called Old Crow. And the Old Crow was so sought after that there was a guy running for governor in Kentucky that he said he would give you a shot of Old Crow if you voted for him. Unfortunately, he didn't have enough Old Crow and he lost. But he wasn't the only one. I mean, the Galt House burned down, and the owner of the Galt House in Louisville, his only complaint was that he lost his barrels of Old Crow. So it's thought to be like a great whiskey of that time. But there's a problem. American whiskey faces this a system that doesn't reward the distiller. It rewards the guy who gets the barrel, the wholesaler. So the guy who is buying the barrel, you know, either at the wholesaler level or at the retail level, he's doing all sorts of things to the barrel. He's adding prune juice. He's adding other spirits, grain-neutral spirits. Some of the really bad ones would add stuff like tobacco juice and rattlesnake heads to change the color. The entire effort was to increase the volume in the barrel so he could have greater profits. These were called, in large part, rectifiers. And some of them were good. So there were some very good rectified whiskey around during that time. For example, there was a brand there you may have heard of in the modern sense called Old Rip Van Winkle. Ever heard of that? That was originally a rectified whiskey in the 1800s. So that, you know, so there were some good products that came from the rectified side. But this was in a time of medicinal use of whiskey. And if you had a swollen toe, you drank whiskey. If you were pregnant and you were hurting somewhere, you drank whiskey. If you had cancer, you drank whiskey. If your kid was born and it had jaundice, you poured whiskey on him. So whiskey was used as like a kind of a cure-all before like penicillin, before aspirin. That's what they had. And so if you're diluting it with all this stuff, per the doctor's description, it doesn't have as great of an efficacy. So the distillers kind of formed up in the late 1800s to start lobbying for rights for themselves. And one of the things that they were able to pass was actually one of the very first pieces of consumer protection legislation in our country's history. It's called the Bottle and Bond Act of 1897. It would be one of the last bills that Grover Cleveland signed during that term. And it basically gave you as a consumer a guarantee that the whiskey that you had was distilled in one distilling season, pure, like didn't have any additives or anything like that, cut to 100 proof, at least four years old, and bottled at the distillery. And so that guaranteed you as a doctor or as a consumer that if you were to buy that bottle, you had a government assurance that it was pure. And you can trust it. Now, of course, the medicinal people who were, you know, skirting the law as it was found new ways to do it. And they would they played a few games here and there. One guy owned a brand called Duffy's Pure Malt Whiskey. Now, he would buy advertisements in all the medical journals and newspapers. He'd claim that if you drank his whiskey, you'd live to be 170. If you had cancer and you drank his whiskey, you would be cured. His whiskey could cure gout, the flu, and my favorite, ugliness. But he never said who had to drink it to cure the ugliness. And the government didn't care too much for that. They saw this as kind of a snake oil salesman effort. And so, and at the same time, you had vaccines that were killing people. Like if you were, you'd get a bad vaccine and die. You had soldiers dying of rancid meat. So they were using like sulfuric acid to kind of hold meat over, and they would send it over to the troops, and they would die of food poisoning. So the government pursues this this act that becomes known as the Pure Food and Drug Act. And it protects us from false claims from liquor dealers. And so to this day, you cannot put pure on a spirits label. So nowhere, unless it's in a trademark, you cannot use pure on in America on a label. If you go outside the United States, that law does not apply, obviously. But so pure is not allowed to be put on there. And so the real important stuff from the Pure Food and Drug Act was obviously the vaccines and, you know, the meat preservatives. But all anyone ever talked about was the whiskey. And even after that bill took place, these bad whiskey dealers still found ways to really hurt Kentucky bourbon distillers. One thing that they would do is that they would get, you know, grain neutral spirit and add coloring to it and call it bourbon. And at the time, the government was really pissed off about this. They looked at this and they said, this isn't bourbon. This is libelous to the Pure Food and Drug Act. So they would sue, the government would sue these distillers, clogging up in our court system all over whatever what we called bourbon. What did bourbon mean? What was whiskey? And you had Congress getting letters, and you had the Department of Agriculture getting letters. So President Taft, most famously known for having a large bathtub at the White House, he takes 7 months out of his term to study whiskey and study the various definitions of what whiskey is. And he gave America its very first federal definitions for all of our forms of whiskey, and most notably bourbon. And to this day, we largely use the terminology he put forth. Now, going forward, the one piece of government interference that just really sticks in every drink writer's craw is prohibition. You know, this was a time when people, they thought that we didn't need to drink anymore. And here's why. And when I tell you this, you may actually agree with the temperance movement that was encouraging prohibition. Remember those brothels I was telling you about earlier? Well, now a lot of guys, they didn't know what drinking responsibly was back then. So they would come out of these brothels or whatever tavern and fall in a mud puddle on their way home and drown. And it was such a common occurrence that Kentucky newspapers no longer covered them. And they would make jokes about it like, oh, another guy died, you know, leaving home today. And so we had a lot of widows and a lot of children without fathers because their fathers drank themselves to death. You would have French travelers who the French loved to drink. They would look at us like, what is wrong with these people? You know, these people drink way too much. There's something wrong with Americans. And there was like all these books written but chronicling us just, you know, getting drunk off our ass all the time to the point where we couldn't breathe for 2 days. And then just suddenly we'd wake up out of a drunken coma. And so there was a lot of problems leading up to that. And that's why today you hear the distilling community say, drink responsibly. Please get it right home. You know, the distilling community at that time did not work together. And the brewers hated the distillers, the spirits manufacturers. And they would point toward the spirits manufacturers and saying like, that's the real problem. That's the devil there. You know, we need to penalize them. But beer, we're fine. We're okay. And the wine guys are like, well, you know, we are served in communion, so we're blessed by God. Jesus made wine, and hallelujah, you know. So the winemakers were, you know, would take a different approach too. And when we would go to war with World War One, and the temperance leaders were very clever, and they would say, well, we're going to war with Germany. Let's look at all these brewers. Anheuser, you know, Adolphus, Busch, you know, they're Germans. We're drinking German beer now, and so we obviously have to have prohibition. That was actually a pamphlet that was circulated and was very effective. But during prohibition, we still drank. We still had a lot. In fact, prohibition gave birth to the mafias. You know, it gave birth to all kinds of syndicates that found ways to get drinking into our homes. But there was another way you could get a drink. You had to be sick. In most states, you could go to your doctor and get a prescription for medicinal whiskey. You'd be amazed how many people were sick during Prohibition. It was tough times. And they would also prescribe cocaine and morphine. So, you know, if you had the right illness, man, you could have a good time afterward. I'm kidding. I would never recommend cocaine and morphine together. Or at all, period. Drink responsibly. Tough crowd here, Jesus. And to those listening at home, that was a joke, because I'm getting podcasted here. So after Prohibition, the distilling community comes out on fire. I mean, they are just, they can't get enough investment. And keep in mind, this is the time of the Great Depression. I mean, people can't get work. And the distilling community is like, you're hired. I mean, they're getting, this is how they check and see if you can work for them. You got a heartbeat? Come on in. you know, they would hire just about anybody to work for them, but they were selective in some areas. For example, the bottling lines were very exclusive to women because men were very clumsy. They would, you know, a man in the 1930s trying to put a label on a bottle of bourbon, you would break probably about five bottles out of 20, whereas women were very graceful and could get it around the packaging. So women were exclusively hired for bottling, and women were also hired for, you know, like organoleptic areas and marketing areas. They would just never talk about them. And because after Prohibition, one of the things that they were afraid of was pissing off those temperance women that were running around with pickaxes, you know, beating the shit out of all their saloons in the time. And one of the ways that they thought that they could keep from pissing them off was by not talking about their women. So they put a self-edict on themselves up until 1987 to not include a woman holding a glass of spirit in an advertisement. And they basically had kind of like an unwritten rule that they wouldn't talk about the leaders in their business. That would change some time, but there was reason why they pursued that. And after Prohibition, most states made it illegal for women to be in a bar. Again, connected to those 1800s era prostitutes, it was illegal for a woman to be in a bar, and it was illegal for a woman to be a bartender in most states. That was upheld by the Supreme Court. And those laws did not get stripped away until about like the late 1960s. So it took a very long time for us to shake a lot of that, you know, connection from the 1800s, and Prohibition when it came to women at a bar. Other than that, the money was flowing into American whiskey at an unprecedented rate. And then Germany invades Poland. And I guess, I can't, there are kids here, so I gotta be careful. Germany invades Poland, and we're in a very tight spot. FDR decides to, you know, hold out as long as he can, decides to enter the war, and one of the things that they do is they create special like manufacturing entities within the government. One of them was like rationing grains, and a part of that was they dictated to the distillery community that you will make industrial alcohol. A lot of the distillers will say that they volunteered it. That is not true. They did not have a choice. It's either that the government basically came to them and said, either you make industrial alcohol for us or you make nothing. And the government would give them a nominal fee for making industrial alcohol. And to make industrial alcohol, you have to outfit your still in a much different way than you would make whiskey. So you basically have to push it. Most whiskey stills are only able to come off no higher than, I would say, 175 proof. Is that about right, Clay? 175 proof. But to make industrial alcohol, ethanol or gasohol or vodka, I mean, honestly, vodka is coming off the still at 190. By the way, any vodka fans in the house? Exit signs are right over here. I kid. But no, we'll get to vodka and why it's the enemy of bourbon in a minute. But they had to put in an investment to make industrial alcohol. And so a lot of the little guys were unable to do that. And I mean, we're talking like 300 barrels a year, small distilleries, like in Marion County, you know, the Blairs. You had medium-sized ones like Franklin Distillers who could not afford to take a hit like that, and they decided to sell. All these brands would be acquired by other, you know, large conglomerates like Schenley and Seagram's, and eventually Brown-Forman would get involved and pluck a few assets here and there. And what this led to was American whiskey losing its independence. It mostly became very much about the branding and the sales and the big money conglomerates than it was about the smaller distilleries. And then after the 1940s, you start seeing a kind of a race competition in the marketplace, and a small brand called Maker's Mark comes out in the late 1950s and makes a big impact. And at the same time, the distillery community was trying to go overseas, but places like Brazil and Great Britain and Argentina were saying, yeah, we don't want American whiskey. Or, you know what, we'll take it. We'll tariff it at 400%, but you're going to pay to come in here. And American distillers were like, why? What's going on? And largely, you know, they were saying, bourbon is special to the United States. We need to have this over here and be sold as a unique product. And most countries were like, no, actually, you have no special designation. And that went on to the bourbon distillers trying to sell themselves as uniquely American. And one of the things that they did was they came up with a legend. There's a legend of Elijah Craig. You know, he was this Baptist minister. His barn fire, his barn catches fire, and his barrels char on the inside. Now, I'm no scientist, but I don't know how a barrel does not get, you know, charred on the inside while the outside is still, you know, clean. I don't know how that happens. But then I got to thinking about it for a second. He's like, he's looking at me, he's like, yeah, all right, here we go. He's a Baptist minister, right? It was a great immaculate charception. Yeah, is that bad? That was pretty bad, yeah. But it was good bad. But no, they create this entire legend around Elijah Craig in the barn fire. And they say that he did this on April 30th, 1789, the same day that George Washington was sworn into office. So they were trying to make themselves sound extremely American. And their entire goal was for it to be for them to become a unique product of the United States on April 30th, 1964. But there was one New York congressman who blocked it. He didn't want bourbon to be a unique product of the United States because he had ties to a distillery in Mexico that was churning out Mexican bourbon. Anyone here ever had Mexican bourbon? Stay away from it. You've had some Dowling. It's awful, right? My man knows. It is awful whiskey. If you ever see Mexican bourbon, just stick to their tequila. Their tequila is amazing. Mezcal is amazing. We can't do tequila and mezcal for a damn, but they cannot do bourbon for a damn either. But anyway, so it tasted like I've had a few drams of it, and it was not very good. It was a cross between Brut cologne and toilet water. So at least what I remember from my elementary days. At any rate, so this New York congressman, James Lindsay, who was extremely important in the civil rights movement. So I'm bringing up these world leaders and like where they play in the greater scope of life. Like James Lindsay was this iconic civil rights leader. And he tried to block bourbon because he was trying to help the ladies who was connected to this distillery, this Dowling distillery in Juarez, Mexico. And he read a poem and he cried on the day that he lost. He was able to block it, but it went to vote after the weekend. And he cried on the floor on the day he lost. And after that, you would think bourbon's owning the world. It's a unique product of the United States. It can't be made anywhere else in the world without the United States coming after you for a trademark violation. But here comes vodka. Probably one of the most iconic films of our time. The guy goes up to the bar and he says, I want a martini shaken but not stirred. And that changed the drinking culture. People started drinking white spirits. It was a little bit of that, and that generation didn't want to drink what their parents and their grandparents drank. And so you started seeing a decline in bourbon sales. And you remember I said that those distilleries were now conglomerates? What do you do if you're a conglomerate? You've got an MBA right here who's trying, you know, he's looking at the entire portfolio, and he's seeing bubbles, and he's seeing sagging sales. And he says, okay, well, let's divest over here. And let's put those resources into vodka. And that's what happened. And the bourbon distillers who were still connected and still in the business were like still trying to fight the fight, but they were trying to fight vodka on its own turf. And so they would pour vodka or bourbon with the orange juice. That didn't work. They were trying to make it like equal to vodka in like the end ones with like cranberry juice and sodas. that didn't work. And so they didn't really know how to compete with vodka. And so what they did was is they created an entirely new category for American whiskey. It was called light whiskey. And it was they distilled it between like 160 and 180 proof. And they put it in used barrels. So it would have some of that neutral characteristic. And it was such a flop. The brands were such horrible representations of American whiskey that to this day, if you mention the brand from Brown-Forman, you may get fired if the right person hears you in the hallways. These were some of the, they invested like, you know, $15 million in these brands. And then, you know, 1969 to 1972, I mean, it's a lot of money today, but it was a lot of money back then. And it just all fell flat. And to this day, there's only like one distillery that makes light whiskey. So the 1970s come along, you have distilleries closing. You have Stitzel Weller closing, Old Taylor selling, Willett begins to convert its distillery. You have brands getting sold off. You have people getting laid off. And everyone's moving in, you know, different directions. By the early 1980s, cream liqueurs are outselling bourbon. Think about that. You know, spoiled milk and vodka with sugar were outselling American whiskey. And that really hit the business hard. But the passion never went away. You had Maker's Mark that was still selling really well. You had Jim Beam that was still selling very well and mocking vodka with their advertisements. You had Evan Williams, which is doing quite well. And you had a little brand like Wild Turkey developing markets in Asia and Australia. And then you had people start to think about, like, well, what can we do, you know, since they didn't have, like, the watchful eye of their, you know, their corporate, you know, people looking over them. And the government had pulled out of the warehouses a little bit, so there wasn't as much there wasn't as much government oversight in the early 1980s. Like, what can we do? Elmer T. Lee came up with the idea of doing a single barrel, a commercially available single barrel. Blanton's, which... I learned tonight the dean of the libraries is a big fan of Blanton's. Not. He came up with his idea for Blanton's. And it was kind of, you know, today we think, like, oh, well, big deal. He bottled a single barrel and put it on the shelf. Ooh, whoop-de-doo. But it was a big hit. But not here in the United States. It was a hit in Japan. The Japanese loved anything to do with American whiskey. And then Booker No comes up with this idea. It was not his idea, but he kind of like pioneered the commercialization of it, of taking choice barrels, so barrels that he tasted and he liked and thought would pair really well with these two, and he would batch them and call it small batching. Now, this had certainly been done before, but this was any time anyone had ever connected the technique with the marketing. And so he did the small batching, and he bottled it uncut and unfiltered. And that was targeted for Japan. In fact, every single bit of innovation in the 1980s and early 1990s was targeted for the Japanese. They love American whiskey. And to this day, you'll find some of the very best collectors are in Japan because of their love for American whiskey. And by the way, that goes way deep into their culture. In the 1800s, they were one of the larger importers of just barrels of bourbon, and they actually sued the government because they didn't think one of the batches they got was good enough. So they love their American whiskey. But Japan, the market crashes in 92. And leading up to that, all the distilleries were vamping up a couple types of recipes. One of them was a wheated bourbon recipe for a brand called Rebel Yell, that was specifically earmarked for Japan. The owners of that brand were like, well, we lost Japan. There's no use of doing anything with this wheated bourbon. So let's sell it all. And they sold it to a company, majority of it to a company called Sazerac, which is Buffalo Trace and now 1792. And they would divvy out a little bit of it here and there to like brands like Jefferson's and a brand that was connected to the founder of the distillery in which they worked, Sitzweller, Julian Van Winkle, who was bottling a little thing called Pappy Van Winkle. And they were putting this stuff out on the shelves, and people were loving it. And that with that vamp up for that whiskey, that increase of whiskey distillation in those early 1990s was very important for, you know, appealing to people. And other companies, instead of selling their brands, they were like, all right, well, we made all this whiskey for Japan. Let's focus on the domestic markets. And so that's what they did. They would focus on the domestic markets, and they would knock on doors and try to get people to drink it. They couldn't give away things like Pappy Van Winkle. They couldn't give away things like you know, some of the antique collections and stuff from the early 2000s. I mean, it's amazing today that these things fetch $2,000, $3,000 on the secondary market. And now but back then, you could get it for $80 on the shelves if you could find it. At any rate, you had all of these people putting in, you know, new blood, putting in effort to bring back American whiskey on the shelves. Meanwhile, you had people putting in, pulling the plug out of their phone, putting it in their computer, and hitting that modem, and they would get on AOL chat rooms or GeoCities or whatever. And they would start chatting with their friends about bourbon. So before Facebook, before Twitter and MySpace and InstaFace or whatever we're calling them these days, you had people connecting to one another, talking about their passion for bourbon. Meanwhile, the Kentucky Bourbon Trail launches, the Kentucky Bourbon Festival, which is going on right now, by the way, it launches, and you have people from all over the world talking and coming to Kentucky to talk about bourbon. And it just starts to take off, and one brand after another, and one new consumer after another. And then the millennials come. The millennials love bourbon, probably unlike any generation since that World War II generation. You guys drink a lot of it. I don't know, and I think here in Western Kentucky, you guys drink the most. Is it the professors? Yeah. You're 21 though, right? Yeah, all right. I don't believe him. He's not 21, is he? He is? No, he's not. All right. Well, fortunately, we're not drinking. Well, you guys aren't drinking. I'm kidding. So the boom really starts with a little bit of passion for just general people with boots on the ground. And you had these master distillers who had been working in the fermentation rooms and propagating yeast and setting dials for stills all these years. They're taking them out of the still room. Parker Beam, Elmer T. Lee, Jimmy Russell, Jim Rutledge. The list goes on. I mean, there were a few of them that would refuse to leave the still room. Like, most of you probably never heard of Gary Grayhart or Edwin Foote. But those were great master distillers. They just didn't want to talk to you. But they were starting to get out and talk to people. And suddenly those crowds would grow from 5 to 15 to suddenly you're selling out Times Square Marriott, an entire floor of people just to come by and talk to them and taste their whiskey. And so bourbon kind of, it always goes the way that the consumer takes it. So the brands often make a lot of boneheaded decisions and forces the consumers to go away for a little bit. One example I like to give is from a brand I actually respect and admire quite a bit, Maker's Mark. A few years ago, they decided to lower their proof. You know, for years it had been a 90 proof product, but they are just strapped for supplying people. I mean, they can't get boxes of cases of Maker's Mark fast enough to Miami, to Detroit, you know, to Tokyo. Everybody wants it. It's the most allocated product in the world of the mainstay products. And so, like, how can we meet demand? Well, someone came up with the idea of saying, well, what if we lower the proof by 6 points? Now, they would claim that they would go through their tasting efforts and everything, and there was no taste difference. You know, I tasted it, and I found the difference. But, I mean, it was not, it was minuscule, but there was a difference there. But when they did that, the internet blew up. It was the lead story on CNN, Bloomberg. I think it made a front page of a couple of the national newspapers, and it trended on Google News. Jay Leno even made jokes about it. So you had, and this went on for 7 straight days. And that was a moment for me when I realized that bourbon had kind of eclipsed this, like, just, you know, good old boy spirit, or where we were just, you know, kicking back on the front porch and without our shoes. Maybe we were in overalls, and hell, maybe we didn't even have a shirt on. I don't know. But there's this kind of like, there's been this long time depiction that bourbon is like, you know, a Southern drink. But the people who were really behind a lot of this were from New York, who were really pissed off about it from New York. They were from California, Seattle. And so you saw the reaction and how people felt about a change to a whiskey that meant a lot to them. And the brand, whether a marketing ploy or a true representation of really caring, they changed it back to the 90 proof. And to this day, they don't talk about it a whole lot. But that was a moment where we could see that bourbon went from something that vodka had kind of kicked in the ass, and it had made it the full comeback. And today, we're looking at a situation where there are more than 5 million barrels of bourbon in Kentucky. That's more than people. It's more than people. 60% of every bottle of bourbon you buy goes to taxes. And a lot of those are earmarked for the roads and schools in the counties from where they are. So when you buy bourbon, you help the children of Kentucky. Just remember that. So that's all I have for the night. And I think I have some time for some questions, or did I talk too much? Yeah, questions?
If Elijah, yeah, back here. Yes.
So during your drinking career, I shall call it, were you introduced to bourbon, and when did you discover your passion?
My legal introduction to bourbon?
To save yourself, yes.
Okay. Well, fortunately for me, it wasn't but a few minutes after I had turned 21. I'll never forget it. The sun was setting. The leaves were falling. No. I was walking up my fraternity at Oklahoma State. I was walking up the fraternity steps, and I had a bottle of Jim Beam White Label waiting for me. And I do remember very well that first drink. I remember the first one, and it was a good night. It was a very good night. I had just turned 21. It was a lovely night. And I remember the liquor store we would go to after I turned 21. They had Old Fitzgerald in there. They had Weller. They had old Rip Van Winkle in there. I mean, really inexpensive stuff. But for me, back then, it was not inexpensive. I mean, hell, I was taking out student loans, just so I could get a hamburger back then. And you guys are in college, right? I remember how awful that was. Good God, you have, like, no money. And it gets better at some point. It really does. So that time was amazing. But when I would really start appreciating bourbon a lot more when I joined the Army. In the military, we become connoisseurs of tobaccos and alcohols. So, yes, sir.
Is there a difference in the taste between the bourbon we consume here and the bourbon consumed in Japan?
They will actually make special products for Japan. It's usually based on proof and packaging. Sometimes it's on filtration. For example, Blanton's has like a cash strength product that they send there. Four Roses has a kind of like a black label. Maker's Mark has a black label. And the Japanese are really, really tied to the color black. So, like, all the packaging, a lot of the packaging is geared toward their preferences there. They have very different tastes in terms of of what they like too from a whiskey perspective. In fact, all countries do. In their free trade agreement with us, Australia and New Zealand negotiated that they get bourbon at 74 proof. And by law here in the United States, you cannot bottle bourbon under 80 proof. So they're the only countries in the world where you can get bourbon under 74 proof. And it was, that held up negotiations and their free trade. It's like, no, we want bourbon at 74. I have no idea why. But so every country does have its taste. Yes, sir.
I recently read an article that said investing in whiskey outperforms the stock market and outperforms investing in gold. Do you have any tips or advice for somebody who might want to start saving for retirement?
I'm happy to buy your whiskey right now. So I could help you with some fast cash. There is a lot of that. Kentucky just passed a vintage spirits law that goes into effect on January 1st. And that basically allows you as an individual for the first time in the post-prohibition lifetime of Kentucky to sell, to legally sell your spirit, whatever it may be, to a licensed reseller. So if you want to, let's say you go in your basement tomorrow, or you knock out your basement wall, and you find out that the previous owner left a couple of machine guns and some bottles of bourbon in there. It turns out they're this big ass bootlegger. Yep. You got those bottles. You got to do something with the machine guns, but you can. And the bottles are full, and you can take them and resell them to the to your local liquor store. It'll be completely legal. Yes, sir.
How many bourbons have you tried altogether? And which one would you say is your favorite?
Which one are you buying me, sir? I have no idea how many I've tried. Just today I've tried 5. But sips, little tiny sips. This is professional stuff. Seriously, I'm a professional taster, so I have to taste. I often spit. But when I was a Corsair, what did I sample? They weren't all bourbons, but what did all they sample? I'd sample 3 or 4. They were just tiny sips, right? Yeah, so just like a little bit. You kind of have to train yourself. I joke around, I kid a little bit about my first drink and all that. But this is a very serious profession, and people get burnt out real quickly. I've been doing it for over a decade, and in my career, I've seen people who can't, do it responsibly, and they kind of phase themselves out. It's a very, if you're not able to do it responsibly, you kind of push yourself out, because we don't go to events drunk. It's not something that we would encourage. In fact, it'd be very irresponsible of anyone in the business to get drunk and pass out in an elevator and shut on them. Not that I've seen that happen to anybody.
One more question. Anybody?
You said Elijah Craig wasn't the inventor of bourbon. Who was?
Well,
do we have to read your book to find out?
I pose some theories in there. And the fact is, we don't really know. After there have been about 20 people who were connected through various points in history of who were to bourbon. And certainly Elijah Craig, there's a good amount of evidence that would suggest that he would be in that circle. And one of the things that was in his circle never actually named him. One of the things that tells me that he may not have been was it was not mentioned in his obituary. And nowhere in his life up until the late 1800s is he really started to be celebrated as a distiller. And oh, by the way, it's very convenient that during that time frame it's Baptists who are pushing for prohibition, and he happened to be a Baptist minister. So that's the one thing that I kind of point toward, is it is most likely that they started to crown him as the father of bourbon to thumb it in their eyes. But there's one individual, I believe, that I found enough evidence to point with a quality educated guess that he would have been the first, and that's a guy named Jacob Spears. You'll read more about him in the book Bourbon.
Well, with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now.